From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. How does someone become a saint in the Catholic Church? Kenneth Woodward discovered it's a combination of faith, bureaucracy, miracles, and public relations. Woodward is religion editor of Newsweek. On this edition of Fresh Air, Making Saints. Many Westerners have traveled to India in search of spiritual guidance and mystical truths, and that amuses Indian writer Geeta Mehta. Mehta is the author of the best-selling novel Raj. She talks with us about the influence of the West on the East. And world music critic Milo Miles introduces us to Ray Lama, a singer, songwriter, and bandleader from Zaire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Pentagon says that U.S. forces have begun entering northern Iraq in search of areas to build refugee camps for thousands of fleeing Kurds. Spokesman Pete Williams says the encampments will be put together as quickly as possible. He says that reinforcements are going to be needed to finish the work, but said he didn't know just how many troops will be involved in the operation. Besides the military personnel who construct the camps, an additional rapid response force will be installed to deal with any Iraqi reaction. The Iraqi government has criticized Allied relief efforts to help the Iraqi Kurds, saying it is hampering their own efforts to solve the refugee problem. The government would not give details about any forthcoming solutions. From Baghdad, Bob Simpson filed this report for the BBC under Iraqi restrictions.
The Iraqi Foreign Minister, Ahmed Hussein, has denounced President Bush's statement that American and European ground and air forces would be involved in setting up refugee camps in northern Iraq to provide relief for Kurdish refugees. The minister said not only would such an action be a continuation of the policy of intervention in Iraq's internal affairs, but in practical terms, it was unnecessary. It would interfere with attempts to find a solution to the problem, he added, as Iraq was cooperating with the United Nations envoy, Prince Sadruddin Aga Khan, to ensure that all the necessary means be found to deal with the problem. The foreign minister said an agreement in principle had been reached with the United Nations officials now in Baghdad. The Iraqi government has also said that more than 16,000 Kurds returned home yesterday, and that in all, almost 90,000 had left the border areas and gone back to their towns and villages during the past week.
Bob Simpson reporting for the BBC from Baghdad. The nationwide rail strike is causing major disruptions at the country's marine terminals. In Washington state, port authorities say they have room to store cargo, but not for long. From member station KPLU, Jennifer Schmidt has more.
Ports of Seattle and Tacoma are two of the country's largest marine terminals and a major link to Pacific Rim trade. Most of the goods that come into and out of the ports go by train. Now that the trains have stopped running, containers offloaded from ships will simply stack up. Port of Tacoma spokesperson Rod Kuhn says the extra cargo can be stored for a while, but he adds the port will still lose money.
If there is no rail, there's less cargo activity at the port, fewer longshore hours, and there's quite a ripple effect on the other support industries as well.
If the strike continues for more than a few days, port officials say they will hire trucking firms to deliver some of the goods, but they concede that many incoming ships may end up going to Canadian ports. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Schmidt in Seattle.
On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow rose over 17.5 points to 3,004.46. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading of 247 million shares. This is NPR. The House has approved a democratically written budget for 1992 that totals nearly $1.5 trillion. It rejects President Bush's plan to cut Medicare and other benefit programs. By a vote of 261 to 163, the representatives adopted a spending plan that puts billions of dollars in education and other social programs that the president wanted to spend on law enforcement and science. And across the way, the Senate Budget Committee voted 11 to 10 today to adopt a similar plan drafted by its Democratic chairman, Senator James Sasser of Tennessee. The second day of the summit between Japan and the Soviet Union ended with what appears to be a serious deadlock on the issue of disputed territory. NPR's John McChesney reports.
Spokesmen for both countries announced tonight that no agreement had been reached on the disputed islands at the northern end of Japan. The islands were seized by the Soviet Union at the end of the Second World War, and Japan wants them back. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and Japanese Prime Minister Toshiki Kaifu will go into a last-minute fourth meeting tomorrow to try and resolve the dispute. In a speech to the Japanese parliament today, Gorbachev told the members that he needed their economic assistance to salvage his reform program at home, but his speech stopped short of offering a deal on the islands. The Japanese have made large-scale economic assistance to Japan dependent on a satisfactory resolution of the dispute over the islands. So at this point, it appears that Gorbachev may go home empty-handed. In Tokyo, I'm John McChesney reporting.
The Assembly of Yugoslavia's largest republic has given its approval to an agreement that will end the largest strike in the nation's history. Serbia's Assembly agreed to the proposal that will put 700,000 metal, textile, and footwear workers back to work. And tens of thousands of Eastern Germans rallied in the streets of Berlin today, demanding that more be done to save jobs and the economy of what was former East Germany. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Christianity is unthinkable without sinners, unlivable without saints, writes Kenneth Woodward in his book Making Saints. Woodward is religion editor of Newsweek. His book investigates how the Catholic Church decides who becomes a saint. It's a process intended to reflect God's judgment, but in reality, it gets bogged down in bureaucracy. Woodward says there's a tendency to confuse the mysterious ways of God with the unnecessarily mystifying ways of the saint-making process. He told me why he investigated the process.
Well, you know, I didn't know how it worked, and I don't think most Roman Catholics know how this works, nor do most people in the Vatican really know how it works, nor do they know about the changes that took place. That's one reason. The other reason is I think that when you look, step back and look at this religion called Christianity, and this is in its Catholic form, that all the adherents are called to be saints. And then I got to thinking, too, about the decline and the cultural saliency of saints. We still have, we venerate, in effect, artists, less so politicians, warriors from in certain innings. But the saint has really slipped from our view, and I think it's we've lost something considerable when we lose it.
What's the function of saints in the eyes of the church?
Well, in the eyes of the church, it's to provide contemporary and therefore relevant models of behavior for the faithful, and to say that you can be a follower of Christ and yet this way as well. My problem is that all the models tend to look the same. They're turning out the same model every year, and I think they need some variety.
As you point out in the book, a lot of people pray to saints for miracles or for favors. Do you think that there's been a kind of deterioration in in the relationship between Roman Catholics and their saints?
Oh, there certainly has. I mean, since Vatican Council II, they've tried to curb, which was an excessive and sometimes idolatrous devotion to saints. I mean, you know the old joke, they say, go to Italy and stop anybody on the street and ask them if they believe in God, and they'll say no, but Mary is his mother. They felt there's a certain deflection taking place, and therefore a correction should take place. But I think now that that's happened, we ought to begin to appreciate saints, and appreciate them not so much as people as figures to pray to, at least this is my judgment, but as stories to tell. And if they are told well, they can provide the kind of literature on which the Middle Ages thrived. And I love the old stories of the early Roman martyrs. They're legend and apocryphal and so forth, but they're absolutely wonderful folk literature.
Can you give us a very brief overview of how saints are selected?
Yes, let's begin with the notion that there are many, many more saints than they could possibly want to canonize. So if you are selected, how are they done it? How do they do it? Well, the first thing is that it's in the beginning phases, it's the most democratic process in a not terribly democratic church, which is to say a reputation for holiness has to be developed after the death of someone. We think so-and-so is a saint. We demonstrate it by going to his tomb. We invoke his name. We talk it up. We issue a prayer card. Then a group gets behind it called the promoters. And if they make enough noise and make a significant enough case, a bishop must take it up. The key player is the bishop. If he doesn't take up the cause and make it official, nothing happens locally or in Rome. Then he investigates the person's life. Did they die as a martyr or were they heroically virtuous? He gathers everything they've written about them, everything written by them and about them. They call in witnesses. And when they get all the documentation, they're satisfied that there's a good chance for a saint here. They send it on to Rome. Rome looks the material over, creates a what I want to call a historical, critical, spiritual biography, complete with footnotes and so forth. This is given to a panel of 9 theologians. If 2/3 approve, it goes to a panel of similar number of cardinals and bishops. And if they approve, it goes to the Pope. He calls them the person venerable. Then they bring on a miracle, and it is judged by a panel of doctors in Rome as to whether it is medically explicable or inexplicable. Then it's passed to the theologians if it's termed inexplicable, who then determine whether there's a possible miracle here. And then it goes on to the Pope. You need one miracle for beatification, one more for canonization.
In 1983, there were some reforms in the system. What were the changes?
Well, they were really enormous, and it's been muffled. You don't hear about it. But we've all heard of the devil's advocate. It's a wonderful phrase, novel by that name and so forth. The process for making saints was a juridical process. It was in the hands of canon lawyers. And certainly well into this century, it had the reputation for being the most exacting and fastidious legal process in the world. Well, as a matter of fact, it wasn't, and there were a lot of complaints. They would very often get witnesses who had only known the candidate for sainthood when the candidate was very old, and now these people were very old. In other words, the oral testimony was not terribly helpful. So they decided to not make it a legal process anymore, and after 400 years, it isn't. It's more like a PhD dissertation. In the sense that there's a man who is like the dissertation master, and he guides the collecting of evidence and the writing of the documents. They've moved to a narrative mode and away from a juridical mode, which was always proving something.
So it's gone kind of from the courtroom to the academic model.
Exactly.
Now, what are the politics over which nominations get pursued and which don't? Is there a certain kind of saint that's favored by the church, that the church is more likely to pursue?
Well, I can tell you right now, because this book, after all, is a journalist's report.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, they are dying to have lay saints. That's their top priority. And along with that, they would love to have, because they have too many clergy. They have had too many bishops, too many nuns who were founders of their religious orders and so forth. They would love to have more intellectuals. But the people who are least likely, based on past experience, to be made saints are intellectuals and happily married lay people and popes. There's only been 3 popes canonized in the last 900 years. If you want to be a saint, don't get yourself elected pope.
Kenneth Woodward is my guest, author of the new book, Making Saints, How the Catholic Church Determines Who Becomes a Saint, Who Doesn't, and Why. Well, you need one miracle for beatification, 2 miracles to become a saint. What is the meaning of miracle in the 20th century where there's a very advanced knowledge of science? I mean, I think that, you know, humans' knowledge of the way the world works and the way certain mysterious forces work are very different now than they were 2,000 years ago.
Oh, yes, of course. And there is much discussion in some considerable controversy within the congregation as to whether they should continue to require miracles of healing, because the doctors involved in the process are becoming ever more fastidious. But I disagree, if I may, Terry, with your premise.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is the notion of miracle, given modern science, is much more acceptable today than it ever was in the heyday of the mechanical Newtonian universe, where there were natural laws to be discovered. We know from studying the micro-entities as well as the macro, the universe, that that happenings have more to do with statistical occurrences and so forth. In other words, we have an image of our world which is porous to things that are inexplicable and so forth. It's really an outdated Enlightenment view to suppose that miracles can't happen. I take the view that a miracle for one who believes in God is a form of gift. I think a lot of us, and myself included at times, do not want to acknowledge that most of the good things that happen to us come in the form of gifts. We have this myth of ourselves as our own self-made people. As a matter of fact, we're not. But the problem in the Vatican is that they are insisting on, they've fallen in bed, actually, with modern medical science. Because the irony is that in order to have a miracle, you have to have modern science to show that it couldn't have happened by any other way except a miracle, you see. And this works to the disadvantage of third world countries which don't have the medical facilities and the record keeping and so forth, all of which is required so that they can rule out any other natural explanation for what takes place.
Give us a sense of what recently has been described as a miracle by the church.
Somebody has a life-threatening disease, certain kinds of cancers, those with high rates of spontaneous spontaneous removal are not included. But a person is almost dead. They have to recover instantaneously. It has to be complete, and it has to, you know, last the rest of their lives. And they watch these very closely. But there was one case where somebody's foot was, they were born with their toes turned in. It was practically a U, their foot was. And after praying to this candidate for sainthood, within 2 days, the whole thing just stopped, turned around completely. And they brought in doctors to ask whether there was any way this could possibly happen. Well, some of the most impressive writing that I saw were the letters that accompanied the healings that could not be explained. And the doctors are not by any means all Roman Catholic. Obviously, they're Jewish, Protestant, non-believers, and so forth. A lot of things happen in medicine that we don't know that are not explicable.
So most miracles today are medical in nature. They're people who've had sudden and inexplicable reversals.
That's right. About 99% of them are medical, and they keep insisting on that. Now there is some movement to talk about non-medical miracles. Supposing someone has been an alcoholic all their life and they suddenly stop overnight and so forth. This has actually been proposed. They are a little wary of this sort of thing, saying, well, supposing the guy falls off the wagon and there's no real healing there. As one of them put it to me, now, if you have an alcoholic, a diagnosed alcoholic, and that person stops and then is able to take a drink again without becoming alcoholic, he says, that would be a miracle.
Yes. Right. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Kenneth Woodward. He's the religion editor for Newsweek magazine, and his new book is called Making Saints, and it's about the process of making saints in the Vatican. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kenneth Woodward. He is the religion editor for Newsweek magazine and author of the new book, Making Saints, How the Catholic Church Determines Who Becomes a Saint, Who Doesn't, and Why. One of the things that the consultants look for in deciding who should be a saint is mystical experiences. And you asked a very interesting question to one of the consultors. You asked, what's the difference between psychological disturbance or, you know, like thinking you're hearing voices because you're schizophrenic? What's the difference between that and heightened spirituality? Was there an example that you were thinking of in particular? And I'd like to hear the response that you got.
Well, My main concern was this. The idea of the mystical life, it's the most interior life of prayer with God. And I thought that they would treat the mystic as a special category, like they do martyrs. And then I discovered that, as a matter of fact, they get very nervous around purported mystical causes, because a lot of them have secondary phenomena, like levitation, like reading hearts, which is to say to know what's on somebody's mind before they tell you. The stigmata, which we've seen in a number of individuals and have been authenticated, that is to say the five wounds of Christ in their hands, feet, and in their side. They call it a secondary, and they don't like it because the people get very excited, and they say, look, you may walk on water, which has got some biblical precedent to it, but that doesn't make you a saint, because you may take pride in that fact. So they go to study their virtues. And in the same way, when they come across somebody, they look to see what this effect had on their lives. Were they puffed up about it? Did they go on television with it, for example? That would be a very bad case. So there was an instance where I found that it's very good to look at the humble, old-fashioned virtues. Were they prudent? Did they care about other people?
But getting back to the difference between a psychological disturbance like schizophrenia and a heightened spiritual experience, hearing voices coming to you from God, mm-hmm. How does the church determine the difference? Now that we know as much about psychology as we do.
Well, I wish they had more psychologists and psychiatrically trained people in the congregation than they do. As a matter of fact, they don't. But they do have some consultants with some experience along these lines, and I managed to talk to them. I think they all give, like you would imagine a doctor might, they all give their rather personal interpretation of the material that is handed them. I mean, usually they don't have a chance to examine the person. The person's been dead for a long time. All they have is whatever writings or documents are there. I think that they are perfectly willing to say, all right, we see some Freudian symbolism here. One of the cases I study or discuss in the book is Alexandrina da Costa, a rather attractive Portuguese woman who had visions and would go through Jesus's passion. She would go into these ecstasies, and they were rather grim, but she would have visions of Jesus with a straw extending from his breast to hers. Well, that's very Freudian imagery. And they're able to say, well, look, that only takes place in the fantasy. We're trying to get behind these things. The fantasies may, in fact, be Freudian or whatever label you want to put on them. What did they do with these things? Now, if somebody is really and truly sick and is not healed from this, I mean, really psychotic, then they would have a judgment to that effect, and they would dismiss the case.
Kenneth Woodward is my guest, and he's the religion editor for Newsweek magazine and author of the new book, Making Saints, How the Catholic Church Determines Who Becomes a Saint, Who Doesn't, and Why. One of the people up for sainthood now is Dorothy Day, who really gave her life to the poor. And a lot of her greatest admirers don't want to see her become a saint. Why is that?
Well, I can appreciate that. Imagine walking into the church and seeing somebody that you knew, like Dorothy Day, and mm-hmm. I knew Dorothy, and you'd lived with her and admired her and so forth, and suddenly there's this cold statue of her, and it's highly stylized, and you say, hell, that's not Dorothy. You see, and the other problem is that they, when they do these, when they work up these spiritual biographies, and later when they talk about these people, they tend to airbrush any vices that they may have. They want to talk about virtues, and they become unreal. They become plaster saints. And I think that part of the resistance to having Dorothy even investigated is that they don't want her turned into a plastic saint. As far as they're concerned, she is a saint. We don't need what they consider to be the interference on the part of a bunch of bureaucrats in Rome to satisfy us that, as a matter of fact, she is with God in heaven. And by God, we'll pray to her, but to honor her is to go out and deal with the poor in the same way that she did.
Yeah, well, you write that you're concerned that the saint makers are forced to exclude what is really exemplary in the life of a saint, and that is the struggle that they went through between virtue and vice, between grace and nature. You want to see more of that struggle in the story of the saints.
Yes, I'm thinking of the people who are objecting to turning Dorothy Day into a plaster saint. I happen to think Dorothy Day is a saint, if I understand what a saint is. But I also know that she had her vices. She could be very curt with people and impatient with people. Anyhow, she had her sins, she had her vices. I think it would be much more helpful if when they wrote these documents up and they talked about these people, they didn't put halos around their heads and said, look, no, they were human like us, and they, through the grace of God, they transcended these things. Then you could look at them and you can say, well, yes, they're different from me, but they're also very much like me. Otherwise, they cease to be in any way interesting as models for human behavior. They're impossible models when they've never committed any kind of sin.
What's your final critique of the process of saint making?
Well, that you've hit on it already. I mean, I think that saints' stories are important. If they're going to be culturally relevant anymore, we're going to have to learn how to tell their stories truthfully, but in a way that reveals the structure of their experience. And I have suggested that whatever else it may be, that the story of a saint is always a love story, because it's a story of a God who loves and of the beloved who learns how to reciprocate what Dorothy Day called that harsh and dreadful love. We see these figures in Dostoevsky and other places. Why can't we see them coming out of the Vatican?
One last question?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Has this changed the way that you relate to saints yourself?
Oh, I've had saints bred into my bones, so to speak, from an early date. My middle name is Lawrence, and that goes back to St. Lawrence, whose wonderful story about being put in a fiery furnace and announcing 15 minutes later, turn me over, I'm done on this side. I learned that as a child, and you can appropriate those stories to your own sense of identity. I think most of the saints that they make today are not very interesting, and I'm looking forward to Cardinal Newman. But I think, you know, as I used in one of my epigrams, the only sadness is not to be a saint. I used to think the only sadness was not to be an artist, but I've met some artists and I've learned. And we can't all be artists, can we? But we could all be saints. Very democratic. So I suppose I've also learned that I don't really pray to saints. I don't sit and think about these people. I go directly to the source, and I suppose I'm a figure of my own times. But I can imagine other people as saints, and I like the idea of connection that the saint represents. We have in our, if I may go on a moment, we have in our society a sense that we only make connections when we meet each other or we strike a deal or whatever. And the whole saint-making process presumes that between everybody who exists and everybody who ever did exist or who will exist, there is, through God, a deep and fundamental connection. And that we are all connected. So the good that I do affects future generations, and the ill that I do affects generations. And I would like to see us be able to reimagine these connections again. And therefore, the saint is important because he's connected to all of us.
Kenneth Woodward, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Kenneth Woodward is religion editor of Newsweek and author of the book Making Saints. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Our literary images of India have for the most part come from European men, writers like Rudyard Kipling and E.M. Forrester. Geeta Mehta has done much to change that. She's the author of the bestseller Raj. Coming up, India through the eyes of Geeta Mehta. Also, if you follow world music, you know Zaire is the home of the rapid-fire dance music called Soukous. World music critic Milo Miles introduces us to one Zairean musician for whom Soukous is just one of many musical styles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Pentagon says that U.S. ground troops have entered northern Iraq to find suitable campsites for Kurdish refugees. U.S. officials say 5 or 6 camps will be set up in northern Iraq, protected and run by several thousand U.S. troops and forces from Britain and France. The Pentagon says these camps are expecting to be providing food and medical aid within 2 weeks' time. The U.N. Secretary General has raised questions about the legal authority for setting up the camps. He said that both Iraq and the U.N. Security Council would have to give their approval if foreign troops are sent into Iraq to protect refugees under U.N. approval. In Washington, President Bush said today that if Iraq wants economic sanctions relaxed, it must first allow Kurdish refugees to be fed and sheltered. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president was responding to an Iraqi proposal that Baghdad be allowed to sell almost $1 billion worth of oil in order to buy food and supplies for the Kurdish refugees. But today, before a cabinet meeting, President Bush appeared to reject that proposal. He said the first priority is to get the refugees settled peacefully and harmoniously.
And what comes first is taking care of these people that have been deprived of their homes and that are terrified and also that are suffering very much. So that's the order in which we will address these problems.
Mr. Bush said that after the relief effort for the Kurds is accomplished, then the administration can consider extraneous matters that might be important to Iraq. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
In the Soviet Union, workers at that nation's largest coal mine have returned to work, perhaps indicating a split in the strike movement. Justin Burke has more from Moscow.
The official TASS news agency is reporting miners at the Rasputskaya mine in western Siberia will begin shipping coal Thursday. They decided to return to work after the Russian Republic reportedly took control of the mine from the central government. There is also a promise to turn the mine into a joint stock venture. Meanwhile, strike leaders in the Siberian city of Novokuznetsk are disputing the TASS report. They say the Rasputskaya miners have gone back to work but are not going to ship any coal, merely stockpile it. If other mines follow Rasputskaya's example, it could drive a wedge in the miners' strike movement, which is demanding the resignation of President Mikhail Gorbachev. The strike has spread steadily since the first miners walked off the job in early March, and now it threatens to collapse Soviet industry. For National Public Radio, I'm Justin Burke in Moscow.
According to an industry group, this nation's crude oil production was up by more than 1% in the first 3 months of this year. And for the first time ever, the Dow Jones Industrials closed above 3,000. The Dow Industrials gained more than 17 points to close at 3,004.46 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. For the first time in almost 10 years, the nation's rail workers are on strike against major freight carriers in the country. Both Congress and the Bush administration are seeking a quick end to the walkout, drawing up legislation containing a cooling-off period that would allow an emergency board to make recommendations for a settlement. Plans for a cooling-off time range from 30 to 120 days. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that airline passengers involved in accidents on international flights may not recover damages for mental anguish alone. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
On May 3, 1983, an Eastern Airlines flight departed Miami bound for the Bahamas. Within minutes, all the engines failed. The plane plummeted, and the passengers were told the plane would be ditched in the Atlantic. Fortunately, the crew was able to restart one of the three engines, and the plane landed safely back in Miami. 25 of the passengers on the flight sued, claiming they should be compensated for the mental anguish they suffered. But today, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that the treaty covering international air travel does not allow damages for psychic trauma alone. The court left open the possibility that passengers who suffer physical injuries and accompanying mental injuries might be able to recover damages. Today's ruling applies to international flights only, not to domestic flights, which are subject to state law. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Also in Washington, the Commerce Department said today that people living in the East had the fastest income growth during the 1980s. The state with the highest average income was Connecticut, with a per capita income of over $25,000. New Jersey was second, followed by Massachusetts, New York, and Maryland. Mississippi had the lowest per capita income at less than $13,000, for almost $6,000 less than the national average. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Indian writer Gita Mehta explores the way in which Western culture has affected 20th century India. She's at home in both the East and the West, dividing her time between England, India, and New York, where her husband Sunny Mehta is the head of Knopf Books. Gita Mehta's first book, Karma Kola, was a satiric account of the spiritual seekers from the West who traveled to India during the 60s and 70s. She wrote of corrupt gurus and naive hippies who misappropriated spiritual concepts like karma and nirvana. For her next book, Raj, Mehta turned to fiction to tell the story of British imperial rule in India and the nationalist movement that led to independence. The main character in Raj is the daughter of an Indian Maharaja, who is forced out of her traditional secluded life into a more independent and modern role. Gita Mehta spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. Mehta explained what it meant for Indian women to come out from behind the veil.
At the time that I'm writing, the veil, or if you like, the women's quarters in the royal kingdoms, really were a kind of historical sanctuary. The British Empire had access to Indian men, to the degree that in British India, for instance, if you were an Indian man, you couldn't go into a British office, into an imperial office, dressed as an Indian. But they had no access to the women, which is why in India, as you see, women still continue to wear the sari, to wear our national clothes. Because the British had no access to the women, it was the women who kept alive the idea of what it was to be an Indian, as opposed to a bastardized creature that had been created by, if you like, the white man's burden, who took the people that he had colonized and made them into a hybrid more acceptable to himself.
Is it unusual in Indian literature about this period to focus on the story of a female character?
Yes. I mean, it's even unusual to focus on the area in which I'm writing, which is Royal India. Most of the writing that is done on the period that I'm writing about was really done by Englishmen. E.M. Forster comes to mind as the great writer of this period. But before him, there was Rudyard Kipling, Ackerley. But these people were all writing about India through the British prism, through the lens of the British seeing a colonized people. And to that extent, it was an inaccurate picture, in my view. And certainly, they wrote largely about men. I mean, even E.M. Forster in Passage to India, though he has a major female figure, the story really is more about Dr. Aziz than it is about her, I think, in some way. So I think I'm unique in writing about a woman, yes.
There have been several recent films and TV shows about India, like Gandhi, and you mentioned A Passage to India and The Jewel and the Crown. Can you tell us more about what you think about those?
Well, I have to tell you, Gandhi, I don't know. I thought it was too fruity by half. there was, you know, when David Lean tried for years and years and years to make a film on Gandhi, and Nehru wouldn't let him do it. But what he used to always to say to Lean, while Lean was sort of working on the script and so forth and so on, is that if you are going to make a film about Gandhi, don't sanctify him. He was too great a man. And when they were making Gandhi in India, the story doing the rounds was, but was Gandhi great enough man to make Attenborough into a great director? And the feeling in India was that he didn't quite pull it off. He had these great sort of set pieces, but the in-between, it was too hagiographic, in a sense, that film. It really did make Gandhi into a saint rather than a man, in my view. Passage to India, you know, I do think that Lean is a great filmmaker, and I thought he produced cinematic images in Passage to India, which stay in the mind. those erotic statues with the monkeys running down them is one of the great images about the savagery of India, you know. And I think many of the people who went to India in search of salvation discovered that what they thought was a smile of benign, erotic divinity was suddenly broken by the harshness of these savage animals that come running down the face of this tranquility. So I think Lean pulled off cinematic images that told you more about India.
Could you situate for us your childhood in the context of the independence movement in India? Was India independent yet when you were born? Or?
Well, it was about to become independent. I was born 4 or 5 years before we achieved independence. 2 weeks after I was born, my father was taken off in handcuffs to British jails, where he was kept for the next 3.5 years, a year in solitary confinement, all that kind of thing. But that was such a... So I was sent off very early to a boarding school, I mean, at the age of 3, while my mother sort of chased various British officials trying to get my father's release. But I think that many Indians of that period had similar experiences. My family, on both sides, were connected very strongly. Some of them were connected to the nationalist movement. Others of them were connected to Royal India in various positions as prime minister and so forth. And still others really thought that the British Empire was a good thing. So my family allowed me to have the span to understand India in those years before the British left.
Why was your father put in prison? What kinds of things was he doing?
Well, I think he was saying that, you know, it would be a very good thing if India was independent of the British Empire.
When you were a child, did you hear about Gandhi? Do you remember what kind of impression he made on you?
Oh, very much so. In fact, my earliest political memory was being sent out onto the streets of Delhi when Gandhi was assassinated to watch his funeral cortege go by.
How old were you then?
I was 4.
So, and you remember that? What kind of impression did it make? Did you understand it?
Oh, a huge impression, because it wasn't like the movie, you know. What it was, it was very humble. I remember just those streets, you know, 3 million people, 3 million Indians came out and just stood on those streets. I remember no color, because white is our color of mourning. Everybody seemed to be in white. And the only sound I could hear was the sound of sobbing. And this truck went by. It was just a simple sort of flatbed truck, and there was Gandhi's body covered in flowers, and all the great figures of the Indian National Movement sitting on this truck, weeping. It was very simple, very humble, and for that reason, much more moving than the cinematic images, you know, of soldiers marching and so forth and so on.
As a child, what did Gandhi mean to you as a symbol or as a figure?
I think what Gandhi meant to me was that he encompassed our finest aspirations. You know, he said it is, first, his pride was wonderful. The mere fact that this man was prepared to wear a loincloth, that this was his great banner against the British Empire. He inspired a desire not to patronize the poor or be terrified of poverty, but to assist in it. And that, you know, he created a kind of austerity in the Indian mind, and an austerity that was worn with pride. So he was inspirational in the sense that he brought out what was finest in India. I mean, in the end, he was destroyed by that which was worst, which was the violence of partition.
You ended up going to a school run by Americans. How old were you when you started there?
I was 5 and a half.
And how was that different for you? What kinds of new things were you introduced to there?
Well, it was wonderful in its sort of sense of freedom, because where I'd been from the age of 3 was a sort of convent, and a very, very strict convent. When I went to the American school, there was that wonderful thing of Americans encouraging you to develop your own personality. But later on, when I was in this school, it was when America was undergoing the McCarthy era. And I distinctly remember bringing a book to school with me from my parents' library called Mother by Maxim Gorky, which I thought was going to be a cross between Little Women and Heidi. And the school being very agitated and saying, well, you know, this is a book written by a communist, and Perhaps we should expel you. And I thought, can they be serious? A 10-year-old child. So on one side, you got the great freedom that American education gives. And at the same time, one was exposed to that really quite frightening moment when all those freedoms were in abeyance in America during the McCarthy era.
I read an article about you, and it said that your mother was afraid you were becoming too westernized, so she took you out of that school. Is that correct?
Yes, and then I was sent back to a convent, because the nuns are the only people who are thought to be strict enough to be the kind of duennas that Indian mothers think can sort of take care of their daughters. Because, I mean, I was raised in quite in a very strict world. We were never unchaperoned. And so when my mother heard that people, boys walked girls home, carried their books, she thought that was unbelievably scandalous. And so off I went to a convent.
Were you getting Indian cultural influences, too? Were you spending enough time with your family, or were you really taking in a lot from American culture?
I was taking in a lot from American culture, but, you know, India is such a strong civilization that, I mean, the British couldn't do it. How can an American school do it? You just could not keep yourself intact from the enormity of India. So I think that one was lucky one had this exposure, this window on the world that was provided both by these convents and far more so by this American school.
My guest is writer Geeta Mehta. Her books Raj and Karmakola have just been published in paperback. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Geeta Mehta is my guest. Her first book, Karmakola, is about the influx of Peace Corps volunteers, hippies, and spiritual seekers who descended upon India in the 1960s. I was reading an article by another Indian writer, Anita Desai, and this was about Indian literature, and she writes this about Karmakola. Geeta Mehta's handling of the theme of Guru Chela, the religious leader and the pilgrim, in Karmakola, shocked Indian readers by its satire and parody. They failed to notice that the satire was directed against those who belittled or demeaned the higher truths. Were Indians shocked by this book? Did they misunderstand it?
Well, I think if the Indians were shocked, it was the extent to which I wrote about their own materialism. And I think a lot of Western critics felt that, you know, I was demeaning the desire for spiritual salvation. I was trying not to. I was trying to say that these things are extremely valuable, and you don't get them for the price of an air ticket. You don't get them because a guru runs ads in American newspapers saying instant nirvana at $100 a day. That if you believe that fantasy, you're treading on very, very dangerous, very thin ice.
Can you give us an example of some of the corruption you saw on both sides of this religious leader and pilgrim relationship?
You know, the corruption basically was fantasy. On one side, you had Indian spiritual leaders who were, to a great extent, corrupted by this mass rock star following that they were getting. These were really rather simple men who suddenly discovered that they had become the center of international adoration. And I think their own power, their own newfound wealth, all of that sort of created practically fascistic situations in their ashrams.
What do you think was the most damaging effect on India from the influx of these spiritual seekers from the West?
You know, I think what was damaging about India is what always happens here. I mean, we just wanted to engage in consumption. We wanted to become sort of rock and roll consumers like the rest of the world. And when the world came to us, that's all we wanted to do was buy, 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 you know, shop till we drop. And when we were told that we could only do so if we traded in our most complicated philosophical concepts, we were only too happy to do so. So, you know, what was awful? I think the fact that we were prepared to prostitute some of our most profound thoughts and tell people that, yeah, you can get this. All you have to do is put on this orange dress that I'm selling you, or put on this rope of beads, or turn vegetarian, and you will get salvation. That, I think, was the most dangerous thing, the cynicism with which Indians sold complicated philosophies and thoughts and made people believe that it was easy to get these things.
Gita Mehta spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. Mehta's novel Raj has just been published in paperback by Ballantine. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. An update tonight on President Bush's plan to have the Kurdish refugees move down from the mountains to camps at lower altitudes back inside Iraq. And NPR's Deborah Wong reports from Turkey about what could be the reaction to that idea. One problem would be the very difficult journey back through the mountains to Iraq. In South Africa, Winnie Mandela says that false evidence has been used against her. She's charged with kidnapping and assault of four young people. More on the police brutality issue in Los Angeles. There are charges that the police department there has not been responsive in the past to charges that excessive force has been used in arrest situations.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We're living in a time of specialization and over-specialization. Even the arts have become very fragmented. When you're a generalist, sometimes people don't know what to do with you. World music commentator Milo Miles has some music by just such an outsider, African pop performer Ray Lamah.
Songwriter, singer, and bandleader Ray Lamar is from Zaire. But unlike the majority of pop musicians in that country, he does not play the jet-propelled kind of rumba called soukous. Or at least, he plays it only in snatches. When you listen to a Ray Lamar record like Medicine or his recent Gaia, all the mix-and-match metaphors come to mind. Mosaic, kaleidoscope, crazy quilt. And not just from cut to cut, but sometimes within songs as well. Such compulsive style switching can mean the performer doesn't know who he or she is. Or most often in American pop, the record is trying to be all things to all buyers. After hearing him for several years with rising fascination, I think Ray Lamar is something much rarer and more refined. He's a widely traveled performer who has determined to go his own way entirely. Lamar stitches together his music from all the styles he has learned to love and comes up with patterns unlike anyone else's. His sound doesn't inspire many imitators, and it belongs to no school. It is, however, in a nonconformist tradition that includes the likes of Eddie Grant, Fela Kuti, Mano Dibango, and of course one of the originals, Sun Ra. Lamar began his career almost 30 years ago as a classical pianist and church organist, but decided his heart wasn't really in it. He began to discover the full range of his interests when he became musical director of the National Ballet and studied folk music all over Zaire. Meanwhile, he played keyboards as a sideman for many leading performers in Africa and later visited America to study jazz and funk. He now lives in Paris, the epicenter of cosmopolitan African pop. All this experience colored his early solo records, which are rather heavy-handed by his current standards. For a while, Lamar seemed to be concentrating on becoming an international dance monster by brandishing heavy hooks in every tune. And he wasn't too bad at it. The climax of this phase was the album Medicine, and it remains catchy, propulsive, quirky. Lema was well into his more dense and intricate presentation of songs with the album Nangadif in 1989. Even when he mixed in trendy flavors like zouk and South African pop, they weren't mere signals that he was hip. They were his particular cosmopolitan idea of zouk, his own measured kind of South African beat. In fact, the more familiar you were with the kind of music he was assimilating, the more original he sounded. In this next number, Lema seems to be picking up on George Clinton-style funk with a sly wink to Clinton's Computer Games album. Lema continues to follow a unique map on his new Gaia. This time he includes slinky, revamped reggae, a very rich and insightful interpretation of Memphis-style soul music, and unclassifiable romps like Technodream. This last number could be a metaphor for Lema's work itself. Technodream begins as an unassuming pulse exercise. It seems routine, even cliched. Then, as you listen, it flies off at right angles and becomes a wonderful babble of percussive voices. It becomes the gigantic conversation of rhythms going on in Lema's head.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ray Lema's albums are available here on the Celluloid and Mango record labels. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8 Talbots. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Paul Schrader wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ, and he directed American Gigolo and Patty Hearst. On the next edition of Fresh Air, Schrader talks with us about his new movie, The Comfort of Strangers. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.